Welcome to Jewish History Soundbites podcast with Yehuda Geber. Immerse yourself in the rich tapestry of Jewish history as we explore fascinating tales and uncover hidden gems from our glorious past. Brought to you by our proud sponsor, Cross River, a leader at the intersection of financial services and technology, committed to empowering the communities they serve. Cross River's steadfast support fuels our mission to preserve our heritage and foster a vibrant future for all. Contact Cross River through their website at crossriver.com.
A date which will live in infamy.
Both of those projects, initiatives, got off the ground because of the Gerer Rebbe.
The 11 Olympic team members slain in West Germany.
Out of the 24 who were killed were Americans who had come to learn in Hebron.
I say 1 million Jewish children who were made to be cut in Husserl.
Whoever heard such beautiful words, Hadunavecha Talmud Bavli.
It is never too little, it is never too late, and it is never enough.
Jewish History Soundbites, bringing alive the world of our glorious past. Here is our host, live from Jerusalem, Jewish historian and tour guide.
Good evening, with Jewish History Soundbites, and this episode is to continue our discussion on Russian Jewry under the Tsars in the 19th century. Last time I discussed with my good friend Davi Safir, we did a joint episode talking about the Cantonists that, and the, in general, the military draft of Jews into the Tsar's army in the 19th century. And it was turned out to be an extremely popular topic. Everyone had a lot to say on it, so we got a lot of great feedback. A couple of people mentioned how that I neglected to discuss the role of the Tzemach Tzedek, the third Rebbe of Chabad, and his role in assisting Cantonists. That was an oversight, obviously, and that's definitely a great story. Maybe one day we'll talk about the Tzemach Tzedek in general, and we'll get to talk about all of his historical leadership. There's a lot of other Cantonist stories some listeners shared. A lot of listeners also appreciated our summary of the tour to Germany, which I'm beginning requests from shuls and groups, and they want to do not just Germany tours, other Europe tours. Things are picking up. So if you would like to arrange a tour, please be in touch with me to anywhere where there's Jewish history. I do to all different countries. You can reach me at Yehuda@YehudaGeber.com. And if you're enjoying this podcast, especially about Russian Jewry under the Tsars in the 19th century, then you can help the podcast by telling your friends and family about Jewish History Soundbites, sharing and spreading the wealth. You can also leave a rating and a review on your favorite podcast platform, wherever you generally listen to Jewish History Soundbites. And this episode is going to be about another angle of the history, the relationship kind of between the Tsar's government and the Jews of the Russian Empire in the 19th century, and that is censorship of books, censorship of writings, of any publications, both imported and locally printed. And the Tsarist government had censorship of all printed materials in the empire, not exclusively of Jews. This was an overall very, very strict, the parameters of Tsar censorship was quite rigid, quite strict for the general populace, including the Jews, and it was part of the autocratic style of government that we can control the population, we can steer the population in a direction that we want through the printed word, through censoring what the materials the masses can access. And this is in the general context of the times. The 19th century is a technological advancement. News spreads better because of the railroad, eventually because of the telegraph later on in the century. Sea travel becomes better. The people have better access to information. The urbanization and industrial revolution gives masses, the used to be only the intelligentsia, they had access to information. There's rising rates of literacy, better education, the rise of media, printed newspapers and periodicals, and an educated class, an educated middle class. And this is, as far as the autocratic czarist government is concerned, is a challenge to be overcome with censorship. And the way to control the population is by censoring the information they have access to in their books and their newspapers and everything else. And this way, we're not going to have any rebellions against the czar. We're not going to have any revolution. We're not going to have any social ferment and divisiveness. And this way, we can control the whole population. That's in general how czarist censorship works. And the specific goals of czarist censorship regarding the Jews made it, for the most of the 19th century, quite different than the general populist censorship. So it's interesting that they had a specific Jewish censorship as opposed to the rest of the population. And Jewish, I mean, at this stage, early in the 19th century, I mean Jewish languages, Hebrew publications for the most part, to a much, much smaller extent, Yiddish, which only came up later in the century, really. So we're talking about Hebrew publications, and in the early 19th century, that's for the most part religious books. And the goals of czarist censorship, and there are shifting policies of this censorship, which we're going to get into and delve into, but in a broad view, for most of the 19th century, the goals of Jewish censorship, as far as the czarist government is concerned, obviously, is to bring the Jews out of their what the czarist government felt was their religious fanaticism, their separation from the Russian population. This is the era of Haskalah Mitam, and even before that, and even prior for that, the government is trying to implement reforms, force reforms onto the Jewish population by integrating them into Russian society, by making them, quote unquote, more productive as far as the government is concerned. This is, as we've been discussing, from their point of view, from their perspective, to solve the Jewish question by taking away their lack of productivity in the economic sphere, by taking away the issues that that make them autonomous and separate, and what they see as the as part of the root cause of the problem is that it's their religious works, their mystical works, their Hasidic works, their religious books, their Talmudic works, all these things have caused them to be separate. So if we censor the publication of these materials, then therefore it will be easier for the government to integrate them, to get an education in the government schools, and so on and so forth. That is the goal for most of the century. Towards the end of the century, the goals shift, at this time, for most of the century, when those are the goals of czarist censorship, they're fundamentally different than the general censorship. The general censorship in the rest of the Russian Empire was to prevent revolution, to prevent, regarding the Poles in the empire. So the czars were very concerned that the Poles would revolt and try to gain independence. To a lesser extent, the Ukrainians as well. And even with the rise of the Russian intelligentsia and the liberal movement, the ideas of emancipation and free, equal rights and all that, the czars, which were an autocratic dictatorship, the Romanov dynasty, they did not want that discussion to take place. They didn't want the masses to have access to these Enlightenment ideas of equality and emancipation and the citizens having a voice. Those were dangerous as far as the Romanovs were concerned, and therefore they had wanted to suppress them and stamp away the ideas. And to a certain extent, the censorship of the Jews was almost the exact opposite. They want them to integrate into Russian society. They want the ideas of the Enlightenment to penetrate from the czarist perspective, the backwardness of the Jews and their separateness, and they need to be equal and integrate and be part of society and not be so separate and backwards and primitive all the time. They need to be more productive. Again, all from the Tsar's government perspective. So the goals of censorship were almost exact opposite by the Jews and the rest of Russia. Whereas in the 1870s and more so in the 1880s, then the censorship issues of the Tsar regarding the Jews changes and actually is streamlined with the rest of the population, because by the end of the 19th century, what concerned the Tsars and his government at this point was not that the Jews were religious fanatics, but just the opposite. Now the Jews are talking about Jewish nationalism. Now the Jews are talking about socialism. Now the Jews are talking about revolution. Now the Jews are have aspirations for emancipation. The Tsars are very concerned about Jewish revolutionaries, and they're very concerned about the new secular Jewish publications and the new secular Jewish newspapers. That's where their fear is now. So they almost completely abandon censoring religious texts. That doesn't really concern them anymore. And all of a sudden, they're really suspicious and really strict and really rigid about all these more secular texts that are being published or attempted to be published in the Jewish population, because they're concerned about revolutionaries and nationalism and emancipation aspirations as far as the Jews of Russia are concerned. And that becomes very similar to the general censorship in Russia. So towards the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, till the revolution, the Jewish censorship and the general censorship in Tsarist Russia was actually quite similar. Now, I'm going to go through chronologically the main time periods that we're talking about. The early years in Tsarist Russia, there was not that much censorship of Jewish publications altogether. It was not organized. It was not so strict. And then that's really the first stage, when the censorship wasn't implemented so much altogether. And then the second stage really is what I've been discussing until now, from the early 1800s until, I guess, the 1870s, the 1880s, the Haskalah Mitam. So censorship was used to guide the Jews in the direction which the government felt was necessary in order to solve the so-called Jewish question. And the third stage is also what I just described, that from the 1880s until the revolution in 1917, a complete shift in gears, because now they're suspicious of secular Jews, of emancipation aspirations, of Jewish nationalism, and revolutionary movements within the Pale of Settlement. So So an important role was played throughout all this by the ones who were actually hired as censors. So until pretty late in the game, until like the early 20th century, literally for over 100 years, whenever there was censorship, it wasn't so much in the beginning, I guess over 75 years, the ones who were the official Tsarist censors for Jewish works, and again, Jewish works in this context means the ones published in Hebrew, primarily religious works until late in the 19th century. So you needed someone who understood Hebrew and was able to fit the government agenda. So the ones who were hired were either prominent maskilim or even apostates, mishumadim, Jews who had converted to the Russian Orthodox Church. Why was that? Because there was no one else. You needed someone who really fit both the government agenda and had a proficiency in the Hebrew language in order to execute the job description. And the ramifications of this reality were quite large, because, number one, there weren't that many people like this. So censorship, as bad as it was, but it was even worse because it went slow. In other words, you had to wait a long time until there was someone available to censor the whatever wanted to be published or imported from outside. Of course, there was illegal smuggling from outside. There was that, but if you wanted to legally import it, then it had to have the approval of the censor as well. So even if it wasn't published in Russia, it didn't solve the problem by publishing it outside of the Russian Empire, because unless you could smuggle a couple in your suitcase when you came in, but if you wanted to actually, you know, bring a large quantity of Sfarim in and sell them, they had to pass the Russian censor. So it took a long time because there weren't that many people. But even more than that, it's what type of people they were. Imagine a meshumad. It's a more extreme example, an apostate. He used to be a Jew, and now he is a Russian Orthodox Christian, and he is hired to censor Hebrew works to fulfill a Tsarist agenda to fix the Jewish population and make sure they don't have any religious fanaticism. You can imagine that how lopsided this is going to be and how unfavorable it's going to be towards Jewish publications altogether. And it wasn't much better under the prominent Maskilim. Sometimes it was. Apostates tended to be worse. Excuse me. That was a reality that had to be contended with. On the other hand, especially when it came to Maskilim, but occasionally even by an apostate, they were Jews. And they very often did feel that they, sometimes they felt they were like between a rock and a hard place, and they wanted to, assist the Jewish people in having their cultural reality of their own texts in their own language, and be able to be proud of their written word and their literature, and they wanted to assist them in getting things published, and sometimes they tried to circumvent the draconian measures that that the Tsarist censorship code required. So it turned out for the better, but it was really not a simple situation. The fact that, and because they were the go-between, these censors, between the government and the Jewish masses, who were ones who procured, who purchased the books. So they were played a crucial role. Sometimes one or two people played a decisive role on decades of Jewish printing. It's a fascinating thing. There's 5 million Jews in the Russian Empire. There's this massive Tsarist Russian government bureaucracy, non-Jewish bureaucracy. And there's three apostate and Maskilim Jews who are deciding the entire publication history for Jewish books in Russia. It's like it's down to just a few individuals. The Jews of Russia obviously did not like this policy of censorship. They did everything to get around it. It was considered a terrible thing. And then the question is, was the censorship effective? The Tsarist government defined very specific goals that they wanted to accomplish through their censorship endeavors. So we can define effectiveness by seeing if they achieved their goals. And the answer is no, it was not effective because it did not achieve its goals. The goals of the Tsar and his government regarding Jewish censorship, like we said, until the late 1800s, was to effectively get rid of Jewish fanaticism and take them out and make them more productive and integrate them. It didn't work. Censorship did not accomplish that goal. It had, I wouldn't say nothing, but it had very, very minimal effect, very little that it did. So as far as that, if that was the goal, it did not achieve it. If we would ask it differently, did the censorship curtail the publication of works in Hebrew or religious works and the like and Sfarim? The answer is yes. So if the goal was to limit the publication or slow it down or to ban it altogether in certain instances or to heavily censor it, then the answer is yes, that it did accomplish. And unfortunately, that was a reality of Jews living in Russia, is that a lot of their works were censored. Some couldn't get published altogether. Some couldn't wait the long publication time, so they didn't even bother with printing it. And we have no idea how much is lost until today, things that remained in manuscript, things that never passed the censor, because of this terrible, challenging censorship policy pursued by the Tsarist government. So that's two ways to look at it. Now, another point to consider is that because of the centrality of the text, of literature, of books in Jewish life in general, where the cliche goes that we're the people of the book. So the censorship of Jewish books was perceived by the Jewish population, and likely was in reality. It wasn't just perceived, it wasn't just perception, it probably actually was in reality. It was a direct assault on Jewish life, on Jewish culture, and the Jewish people. It was considered an assault on the Jewish people as a whole, with their autonomous identity at stake, because the Jews are a religious minority living in this massive empire. They don't have their own territory. They live in the Pale, but they're stuck in the Pale, and a strong component of Jewish identity was their Sfarim, their text, their Hebrew language, their Torah, their just the way they lived their life was so centered around their books. And therefore, the Tsar says, we control your books. We decide what goes was an assault on the Jewish people itself. And that's how it was viewed by the Jews of Russia. So if we take a step back and we go through each of those three stages, delve into it a bit more deeply, we'll find that it was in this, go through this process in a chronological sequence, we'll find that in the initial stage, there was basically no censorship altogether on Jewish works, not imported or locally printed. The partitions of Poland begin in 1772. That means the first Jews of Russia fall under Tsar's control, Catherine the Great, in 1772. And they're completed with the third partition of Russia in 1795. That's when the full Russian Jewish population is formed. So until 1797, which means a full 25 years, when the first Jews come into Russia through the partition, 25 years, a quarter of a century, the government had no way of enforcing censorship altogether, even if they wanted to, because they didn't have any censors who were hired who could read Hebrew with any sort of proficiency. So over the first 25 years, there was no real censorship at all. Even once it got off the ground in 1797, and the first censors were hired, it took a while until there was an effective mechanism of censorship. So from 1797 to 1802, a period of about 5 years, there was a little bit of censorship. The first Jewish censors were hired in Riga. They were very anti-Hasidic, as were most Jewish censors in Russia throughout most of the 19th century. One of the distinctive features of Jewish censors in Tsarist Russia was they were very anti-Hasidic and very anti the publication of Hasidic works, mystical works, Kabbalah, all those things. In fact, the part of the interrogation of the Alter Rebbe, the Baal HaTanya, Reb Shneur Zalman of Liadi, when he was imprisoned, so part of the interrogation was based on a report submitted by one of those Jewish censors in Riga, who wrote about Reb Shneur Zalman's, the Alter Rebbe's Hasidic writings and how, you know, not good they were, detrimental they were, whatever, and the Alter Rebbe had to defend himself, which he did successfully. But you see already that even in the early stage, when there was almost no censorship, they were enough to cause trouble. But from 1802 to 1826, for the next 24 years or so, there wasn't much censorship at all. Again, officially, there was in the faculty in Vilna University, and their Jewish students, in fact, they were in charge of Jewish censorship. That was officially that's who the government made in charge during those years. But practically, pretty much everything went during those years. There was no effective censorship altogether in the Russian Empire of Jewish works during all this time until 1826. So if we would summarize at this stage, for more than a half a century following the partition, from 1772 to 1826, that's a very long time, there was pretty much a free-for-all regarding Jewish books, Sfarim, publication, basically no censorship at all. I think this point is generally overlooked. Based on that, we can point out two other conclusions. First of all, the period of censorship in Tsarist Russia lasted about 90 years, 1826 to 1917. So the idea of censorship is a 90-year period. That's what we're looking at. Not even that, there's a significant relaxing of censorship following the 1905 revolution. So it was even a drop less, because after the 1905 revolution, it was generally much easier to publish. And that real effective and draconian censorship of Jewish works, the second conclusion that we have is that the real effective and draconian censorship of Jewish works commences during the beginning of the reign of Tsar Nicholas, or Nikolai the First, thus reinforcing his well-earned reputation that everything was bad for the Jews under his reign. In other words, that we associate everything bad with Tsar Nicholas, and it's actually true. It's not just a stereotype. Even censorship really becomes bad under Tsar Nicholas. So the Tsar's government laid down a policy, but it's unclear what type of authority they give to these maskilim and apostates, mishumadim, and their jobs as censors. So they say we want to combat religious extremism, we want to combat Jewish ignorance, we want to combat mysticism and Hasidism, it's left to the censors, in other words, these maskilim and apostates, to interpret their job and to try to execute it in the way that they understand is what the Tsar's government goal is. So in 1826, Nikolai's government passes its first clear law regarding censorship of Jewish works and actually hired a bunch of censors to do the work. So here it was laid down. They also added another bunch of rules. Anything critical of Christianity, anything that's not for the benefit of society, anything that's antisocial, anything that's against Russian society, all those things will be forbidden and can't be published, among other things. The main censors who were hired at this point, and they play a big role in the story of the history of Jewish-Russian censorship and publication of Jewish works, is the famous Tagenhold brothers. Zev Wolf Tagenhold was the main censor in Vilna, and his brother Yaakov in Warsaw. And they each served many decades in this position. I think they each served nearly 40 years as censors. And they basically, these two people came to define the position of what a Jewish censor is under the Tsars. Because in order for the censors of Jewish books to execute their job description, they had to be a Jew in mid-19th century Russia who was the most not typical of Russian Jewry at all. They weren't even outliers. They were beyond outliers. They were, relative to the rest of Jewish society, they were really, really different. Why? Because in order to be a censor, one had to have an extensive secular education. They had to have a knowledge of Jewish languages and presumably Russian. They had to be either a maskil or an apostate. They had to be, obviously, a non-chassid, generally an anti-chassid. They had to be open to enlightenment ideals. They had to be known to Russian government officials who needed to approve them for their position. So how many Jews in Russia fit that entire job description? Very few, and they were very, very unique. They were not reflective of the average Jew in the Pale of Settlement. Often, very often, in the 1840s, 50s, 60s, the graduates of the Russian government-run rabbinical seminaries of Vilna and Zhytomyr were the ones who were hired as censors. Very often, like I said, they were even apostates, ones who had been born Jews but converted to the Russian Orthodox faith. And these censors were expected to demonstrate their loyalty to the Tsarist government and its ideals regarding the Jewish question if they wanted to keep their jobs. And this remained the case until the early 20th century. Early 20th century, the job description was changed, and it was no longer ideological, it was rather professional. What do you know? And all the only requirement was to know Jewish languages. So if Joe Schmo, either a Jew or non-Jew, would prove on an interview that he knows Jewish languages, then he would be hired. That was the case in the 20th century, and if we would think of it objectively, with hindsight, it would have made sense to have been the job description from the outset. But no, for most of the 19th century, it was an ideological position, not limited to a professional knowledge of Jewish languages. Tagenhold and others made it their main goal to wage a campaign through the mechanism of censorship against Hasidic works, mystical works, Kabbalah, and all that. They wanted, because that was considered against the Enlightenment, against the enlightened ways of Europe in the 19th century. Halachic works were not their primary concern. That's not to say that there wasn't censorship in halachic texts. There was plenty of censorship in halachic texts as well. But on the set of priorities, that was lower down on the list. I recently had an episode a couple of months ago on the Aruch HaShulchan, or Bichil Michal Alevi Epstein, and I discussed, in fact, which is obviously halachic work, and how much censorship he had to deal with. Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, the great Kovner Rav, had to contend with a lot of censorship in his halachic works as well. In fact, the Shulchan Aruch HaRav of the Alter Rebbe also did, and that's his halachic work, too, and in many, many other svarim of halacha, of gemara, of things, they definitely had the issues. In general, by the way, once we're talking about halacha, not chassidus, so the choshen mishpat areas of Shulchan Aruch, of halacha, which deal with monetary law and business and real estate and contracts and all that stuff. And in the world of finance and commerce, that had the most potential to clash with the Russian law, with Dina de Malchus Adina. And therefore, as far as the censors and the Tsar's government was concerned, Chayshin Mishpat, areas of halacha were considered very problematic. And they sustained the most censorship. Of course, in many other texts, especially Talmudic type of texts, it was more about perceived criticism of Christianity, and you know, in Hilchas Avodah Zarah and Yayin Nesach and all those areas. But for the most part, like I said, the main goal, especially of the censors themselves, but also of the Tsarist government, was waged against Hasidic texts and publications of related to Jewish mysticism and Kabbalah. An interesting phenomenon, which is often overlooked, is the attempts of these censors to walk a fine line between doing their job as loyal censors to the government, and on the other hand, enabling Jewish works and texts and books and svarim to flourish in the Russian Empire, because they also had Jewish sentiments. They believed in Jewish identity and Jewish pride and Jewish culture. And this, the people of the book, like I said, so they wanted that there should be a Jewish publication, should continue, just the Jewish publications that they wanted, not Hasidic ones, not mystical ones, things like that. And therefore, they did try to enable books to be published. Now, in 1836, the most draconian measure in the realm of Tsarist censorship with severe ramifications in the Russian Jewish world was passed, with the closing of all Hebrew printing presses in Russia. That was the worst form of censorship possible, because it essentially put Jewish printing to an end, almost to an end. They allowed only two were permitted to operate in Vilna. It was one, and the second one was initially supposed to be in Kiev, but it ended up in Zhytomyr. What was the catalyst for this? Obviously, we're talking about still during the reign of Tsar Nicholas I. What was the catalyst for this sudden closure of all Jewish printing presses, Hebrew printing presses in Russia? So officially, the reason was that the Slavuta printing press was owned by the Shapiro brothers, Hasidic Einiklach of Rav Pinchas of Koritz, and they owned the Slavuta printing press, and they were put on trial. They were arrested and put on trial by the Russian government because they were accused of their involvement in a murder who was an employee in their printing press. That's another story. It's also related. It's a whole story. We'll talk about it another time. It's related to the Rizhner and his clash with the Russian government and his arrest, and he was framed. But this is not for our topic. This is also related to the famous printing press wars between the Slavita printing press and the Vilna printing press, and the rights to publish the Shas. I think, you know what? I think one day we'll have an episode on that. The copyright law and the rabbis who were involved, and this was also a renewal of the old Misnagdim versus Hasidim dispute in the form of who controls the printing, who controls the printing of Shas, who's going to make the money off it, who has more rabbinical backing. And unfortunately, it ended with the closing of all printing presses and the arrest of the Shapiro brothers. So eventually the Tsar had the last laugh, not the disputing Jews. But in a broader sense, it was also the fault of this Wolf Toggenhold. It was his fault that all the printing presses got closed. His censorship activities and the censorship bureau, and another famous maskil, Yitzhak Ber Levinson, Ribal, his name was known as, both of whom lobbied the Tsarist government to close Jewish printing presses in order to have better control of Jewish works, especially of Hasidic works and mysticism and all that. So the Tsarist reaction was, okay, you Ribal and you Toggenhold think it's a good idea to close Hebrew printing presses? Then we will. And the Tsarist reaction was way worse than they could have anticipated, and no one benefited from this terrible censorship, not the Maskilim, not the religious, not the Hasidim, everyone lost out. And the lack of printing for the next 30 years or so, which followed, except for those two limited printing presses, was a terrible time, and everyone suffered equally, from the Haskalah to the Hasidim and everyone else in between. So, you know, you start to get the Tsarist government involved because you want to get get someone back, and eventually the Tsarist government lays down a much more draconian measure than anyone could have anticipated, and everyone suffers equally. In the mid-1860s, there began a period of liberalization of Jewish printing, a liberalization on the censorship, and this was in line with the general spirit of the great reforms of Tsar Alexander II, which we've mentioned in the past. So there's a liberalization in all realms. The great reforms of liberalization and censorship was expressed in two ways. Number one, more censors were hired, and they were in many cities in the Pale of Settlement and outside of it. So it kind of shortened the time and made it easier to get books approved. That was the first way. And the second way, in general, they did not really target Hasidic and Kabbalistic works anymore. It was less specifically against that. It was less of a war against the specific genre of religious publication. So there was this somewhat a relaxing of the censorship during the 1860s. In the late 1870s, early 1880s, the entire structure of censorship changed completely regarding Jewish texts, which I mentioned before. There was no more issues with religious books, not really. In fact, the Talmud itself, the Shas, was allowed to be printed for the first time in 1880 in Russia as an entire set without any significant censorship at all, meaning they didn't have to do it in individual volumes, and they didn't have to have heavy censorship on it. So that was a major accomplishment, and the same was with all Sfarim and religious texts. This was no longer the goal of Russian censorship. I'm not going to say that it disappeared altogether, but it wasn't their focus. So there definitely continued to be a certain censorship of religious texts, of halacha, of shas, of chassidus, of all kinds of things, but it was much more limited because they shifted their focus. From now on, it was going to be remarkably similar to the general censorship in the Tsarist Empire, nothing special about Jews. Secular texts, newspapers, books. The Tsarist government was suspicious of revolutionary secular ideas. They were suspicious of Jewish nationalism, of socialism, and similar concerns, especially because of the modern media, modern literature, which would be the primary focus of Tsarist censorship of Jewish and general works until the revolution. And it's interesting that in this context, Yiddish newspapers were, and Yiddish literature were, especially of media nature, like periodicals and magazines, were banned by the Tsarist censors for a while, because they were seen as the most radical and socialist, they were a problem. And the new thing on the scene was Russian Jewish periodicals in the Russian language. So all of a sudden there was Jewish literature in the Russian language. So this presented an interesting opportunity for the Russian Tsarist censorship bureau, because for the first time, the government didn't have to rely on a certain type of Jew to be the censors. The regular Russian censors could do the job because they could read it. It was in Russian. It happened to be for a Jewish audience. Primarily in St. Petersburg, these publications were. So the same thing they did, they implemented with the general populace, could be now with the Jews as well, with these Russian language works. And the censorship of these periodicals was extremely strict, and the government did all it could to curtail its influence, as they were quite suspicious of them and their goals. By the end of the 19th century, Tsarist censors were extremely concerned and very strict censorship with Yiddish publications of the Bund and the Bund and others. Hebrew publications of the Zionists were a problem, both of whom the government viewed with great suspicion and attempted to limit their influence through extreme censorship. In the aftermath of the 1905 revolution, many of the government measures were relaxed in general, not just for the Jews, and as a result, another interesting phenomenon, in the last decade before World War I, there's this flourishing of Jewish printing, publishing, literature. In the last decade, newspapers, it's a huge topic, not just in the decade before World War I, but Jewish newspapers in Hebrew, Yiddish, and Russian in the late Russian Empire, I'd say from the 1880s until the revolution, is a great topic in its own merit, and perhaps we'll be able to explore it in a future episode. I want to summarize the topic of censorship by saying several points. Number one, if we take a broad view of the whole long 19th century, as we've always been talking about, in the censorship realm, we see the inefficiency of the Tsarist government. in censorship and their very limited impact. And in general, this is because, and it's reflective of, the poorly run bureaucracy, which was a distinctive feature of the Russian imperial state. So the censorship was no different than that. That's point number one. Number two, this shift that we've been discussing the whole time is fascinating. In the beginning, the problem is religious works, and this later on, the problem is secular works. And because of that, it's a paradox. In the late Russian Empire, there was a flourishing of religious works. It was much easier to publish Sfarim. So that's a great point to emphasize. Number three, in summary, the shadow of the censor hovers over Russian Jewish life. And much needs to be understood in that context when we study things today. The Sfarim that we have today, its availability, its contents, the frequency of its publishing, basic Sfarim, more obscure ones. In other words, Sfarim that we don't have altogether because they weren't allowed to be published. Sfarim that we do have that has been reprinted and republished because it gained a certain popularity. Why was it able to be published? Why did it gain popularity? Why that particular sefer? Which Sfarim were available to the average Russian Jew or the average Russian rabbi in the 19th century because of this censorship? How often was it able to be published? Let's say it was a sellout. Were they able to republish it or did it get censored again? Also, in reading Sfarim from that time, very often it was written in coded language when they wanted to get it by the censor. Sometimes things were only hinted at. And when we, in the 21st century, study these Sfarim, we have to be attuned to that. Oh, this was published in the Russian Empire, and they couldn't write things explicitly, so they're only hinting at it. So when you do your diukim, and what's this sentence really saying? What's this sefer really trying to say? We have to keep in mind that the Russian censor read this sefer 150 years ago, and he controlled what went into it, and therefore the author had to modify his language as a result. So very often the shadow of the Russian censor is with us until this very day. The fourth point in summary is that in general, this whole story is a perfect illustration of the extreme and tight control the Tsarist government attempted to exert over the Jews. And this is what Jewish life was like in Tsarist Russia. So things we take for granted today were almost insurmountable challenges of daily life in Russia under the Tsars. And therefore, that's another thing to point out. It's just reflective of the control, the autocracy and the tight control, that extreme tight control that the Tsarist government had over Jewish life in Russia, which we don't even appreciate today. Because our life is so different. The fifth point, delicate point, that I want to say in summary, is there a legacy of this censorship? Does it remain in our world today, in the realm of perhaps self-censorship? Do we legitimize censorship as a method of a control over a community's values, over community's education and direction that we want to shape our literary works as educational messages? So censorship is a legitimate method because we lived with censorship so long under the Tsar. Are these holdovers which we learned from the Tsar? Perhaps, perhaps not. The evidence is inconclusive and the jury is still out on this. So this is Yehuda Geber with Jewish History Soundbites. You can reach me at yehuda@yehudageber.com. For questions, comments, sources, tours, trips, sponsorships, and lectures, you can subscribe. You can and should subscribe to Jewish History Soundbites on your favorite podcast platform. I hope you enjoyed.